It's important to see that this is a negotiating text, and what we're seeing is countries making progress, and that's a good thing. But what's equally important is what is actually in and what is actually out of this proposed text. So I think overall it is moving the process forward. However, we are not seeing things like finance in there in the way in which we would want. And that's things like financing for adaptation programs, which are to help countries like those in the Pacific to adapt to the impacts of climate change that they're feeling now. We're seeing a greater emphasis on mitigation, which is very, very important. However, equally important is to deal with the impacts of climate change that are happening now.
Is there an impression perhaps being given by the UN because of this emphasis on what can be enshrined in international law, is that if you achieve an agreement that has international law overarching it, as it were, that things will start to happen? But history will tell us that's not the case, is it? International law is hard to deliver.
Look, that's true. But, I mean, there's no doubt that a robust or a fair and binding agreement will assist in climate action. I mean, it will mobilise climate action. Now, how much depends on how good the agreement is. And of course, you know, there are always obstacles. But having a global agreement that is a good global agreement will catalyse action and will be another toolkit in the fight against climate change. And, of course, a very necessary one for Pacific Island countries.
In the end, though, a lot of it will come down to cost, won't it? Exactly what individual nations can afford, and if they can't afford it, who can help them?
Yes, look, that's exactly right. Finance, I think, in terms of the Paris Agreement, the agreement that's being negotiated at the end of the year, is really the known unknown. And certainly spending money now on adapting to climate change is going to save money in the long term, but developing countries cannot do this alone. They need the support of developed countries, rich countries like Australia, to assist them in being able to tackle those impacts, things like, you know, soil being contaminated from salt water, fresh water being contaminated, greater sea level rise, these sorts of issues. And so we do need to see rich countries who have done the most to cause climate change contribute financially to those impacts that are happening now.
I'm just wondering why, though, the UN feels it's necessary to differentiate, if you like, between areas which could or could not be enshrined in international law. Because at the end of the negotiations in Paris, if there is to be a meaningful agreement, isn't it a case of all sides saying, well, this is what we want to do and we will make it part of international law?
Yeah, look, I think at the moment what we've seen is the text divided into three sections, and that's what would be potentially in an agreement. And remember, there's a lot of options there in a legal agreement or some other agreement with legal force is what was the wording from Durban. And then the second area is what is likely to be in a COP decision. And then the third area are those areas that are still needing further clarity. Now, the second area, the COP decisions, I mean, I guess what you're looking at there is what you can get parties to agree, so that's all countries to the process will agree to go in an agreement, and what areas you might not be able to get them to agree to having an agreement, but you will be able to get them to recognise they are important as a COP decision, and that is a political process, not a legal process.
It's going to be quite a minefield. I think that goes without saying. And previous global climate negotiations have certainly proved to be that kind of situation. But, of course, the elephant in the room potentially will be Australia. We still don't really know where the Australian government stands and what it will be taking to the table in Paris. So do they or any other objectors to an international agreement have power of veto?
No, they don't. Australia doesn't have power of veto. And look, you're absolutely right. They do risk, leaving. Australia risks being marginalised in this process and being left behind, because let's face it, they simply are not up with other countries on the action that needs to be taken. Now, as to whether they can veto an agreement, the process is via consensus, but what that's been taken to understand over the years is that it's the majority of parties, or almost all. So one or two countries are not likely, and history shows this just hasn't been the case, to be able to hold up an agreement. So Australia could well find that the rest of the world just moves on without it.
The point, though, that the Australian government seems to be pushing at the moment is that action does cost, and ultimately, as we've already touched on, if an agreement is to be successful, it has to be affordable, and people have to be prepared to as taxpayers, for example, to pay the money.
Sure. Look, there's no doubt that action on climate change costs, but inaction costs more. It costs the taxpayers more. It also affects our neighbours in the Pacific and in Asia far greater if action isn't taken sooner rather than later.